Hello, welcome to the Stooshy, the politics podcast from DT Thompson Media. My name's Paul Malik. I'm the Courier's political editor, and I am joined, as always, from some of our top reporters from around the UK. Joining us from Edinburgh, we have Callum Ross, the Press and Journal's investigations editor. Joining us from Westminster, we have Dan O'Donoghue, the Press and Journal's Westminster editor. And joining us from Aberdeen, we have Adele, the Evening Express's political reporter. Good morning, all. How are we today?
Yeah,
great. Fantastic, Paul.
I'm so relieved to hear that. Now, let's crack on. We have had another busy week in Scottish and UK politics. On Thursday, we were joined by the Prime Minister, who decided to take a jaunt up north, despite the fact that it kind of contravenes travel restrictions. Dan, how did that go down in Westminster, first of all? Because we'll talk a bit about how it was perceived up here, which will come as no shock really to anyone listening, I imagine. But in Westminster, I imagine that the feeling was slightly different. What's the chat been down south?
Well, it took everyone by surprise a little bit, to be honest. I mean, it just kind of came out of nowhere. It was a kind of a briefing to the Sun newspaper earlier this week that Boris was going to be heading up north, and then Downing Street were very keen to kind of downplay it at first, not wanting to confirm or deny the story. And then, as is usual, these kind of things, we kind of found out the day before that he definitely was visiting, heading up to Glasgow and Edinburgh, on paper anyway, to see the work of armed service personnel and the vaccine rollout. I mean, of course, in practice, it's to try and make the Prime Minister a bit more visible in Scotland. We're just a couple of months out from the Holyrood elections. And obviously, it's one of the most important elections in UK history, with, you know, the prospect of IndyRef 2 on the horizon. So that really is the reason he was shuttled up there. But no, I mean, it's just kind of garnered a bit of a debate about, you know, all the things probably that he didn't want to see. You know, is it one rule for politicians and another rule for other people? You had Alistair Jack having to defend the Prime Minister's visit, and the PM spokesman saying, you know, he's the UK Prime Minister, he can basically go and do what he wants in the UK as long as it's part of his job. So, I mean, I know the coverage up there, you know, he faced a lot of more angry questions over kind of, you know, the fishing deal and all the rest of it. But no, it was just a visit out of the blue, really.
No, that is interesting. I mean, on the one hand, the argument is that he is the Prime Minister. I mean, if anyone's got a sort of special dispensation to be able to travel to areas that you might not be able to, and then traditionally in the past, if there's been a natural disaster or some sort of catastrophic event, the Prime Minister would be criticised for not visiting that area. And I suppose what's interesting is that the central belt of Scotland has been the highest rate of coronavirus infection, but certainly by no means been the highest in the UK. Now, I was part of the press huddle yesterday, involved with the Prime Minister. Normally that involves being left in a small, dark room for about 3 or 4 hours while he does his visits. There was a time on a farm up in Aberdeenshire where it was very cold. We were at Faslane once, which was great, apart from the fact that we didn't get to see any of the submarines. But this time we were on a Zoom chat. Now, if we were able to do the press huddle on a Zoom chat, it almost leaves it thinking that maybe the visit or maybe the statement could have been done via Zoom or Teams or whatever mode of communications you're using. And it was interesting as well, Dan, wasn't it? The way that even the First Minister had said, well, I don't think it's absolutely necessary. You know, is it a necessary visit? The rest of us are stuck in our house, and I don't know if you saw any of the coverage yourself on the BBC or the ITV, or even heard some of the sound bites that I think it was Classic FM and XFM, that whoever owns that channel, they'd gone to Castlemilk and they'd spoken with residents there, and they were less than impressed. So it is interesting to see how the Prime Minister's visit. I mean, generally when there's Prime Ministerial visit, that's difficult to say, a Boris Johnson visit, he's met with quite a large fanfare, a lot of sort of booing and shouting from Scottish independence fans you know, who almost clamour around the Prime Minister like Beatles fans. It's kind of weird, you know. It's all shouting. It's all people losing their heads. I dubbed them the Scobo Joe fan club. I'm waiting on the trademark of the patent coming back on that. But I mean, how is Boris's reaction received in London? I mean, not so much Boris's actions, but the reaction to Boris's visits to Scotland. Are people concerned about the way that the Prime Minister is sort of just rubbished whenever he comes north of the border, Dan?
I mean, I think certainly you'll see, you know, maybe opinions that way in certain columns in certain newspapers. But I mean, I kind of had this debate with my housemates the other day about, you know, one of my housemates was saying, well, why is he going up to Scotland? I don't understand. You know, it is lockdown and the message is to stay at home. And in one sense, you know, I mean, I know Keir Starmer was asked about this on the radio the other day, and he kind of was, you know, very forceful in his defence of Boris's trip, saying that, you know, he is the UK Prime Minister and he's got every right to go visiting various places as part of his job. I think he was in a rock and a hard place because, you know, in a sense, every visit a Prime Minister does, whether it's, you know, in Sussex or the Shires of England, or whether it's Wales, Northern Ireland, wherever it is, you know, you could almost say with every visit, you know, well, what really is the point of that? I mean, I used to work for a press agency, and we were often sent out, you know, to do all the pool clips for Prime Minister's visits. And, you know, a lot of the time you would kind of wait around, as you have, Paul, for many hours to see a Prime Minister kind of nod and look at a few things in a you know, a building in the middle of nowhere, and then kind of do a clip for the TV cameras. And it's kind of, you know, that's the function of it, really. It's kind of to be out and about, to be seen. And if he wasn't doing that, and these accusations that, you know, he's kind of in a Westminster bubble, he never leaves London, you know, he's deaf to the concerns of the rest of the country. So it's kind of a, you know, it can't really win in this situation. You know, whatever he does, there would be criticism. So it's a difficult one, really, for his advisors, number 10, to play this one, I think.
Yeah, no, I think it will, for as long as he's Prime Minister and as long as this debate is going on, it will be an interesting question as to see how often he comes up and how well he's received. I should point out that he was, of course, late for the Zoom meeting yesterday as well, by a good 20 or 30 minutes, but it's not as bad as it has been in the past, and no one likes morning journalists anyway. Now, moving on, Adele, you've been looking at quite a lot of issues surrounding the future working relations law in the UK and how leaving the European Union could adversely affect women in particular, with a focus on employment rights and sort of hard-won benefits for women in the workplace, which are a staple of EU law but might not necessarily be passed on now that we've left the EU. Can you talk us through a bit more detail of that, please?
I spoke with women's rights groups and legal experts on the impact of Brexit and women's rights, and there's a lot of concern among them that women's voices are just being left out of this whole debate. I mean, as you know, there's certain hot topics with Brexit that get acres and acres of press coverage, and I think they feel not only that the media hasn't looked at it, but also that you know, lawmakers haven't had it as a priority. Their concerns sort of stem around the fact that the minute we left the EU, we sort of lose, what we do lose, the minimum standards that are guaranteed by EU law. So that makes the current rights that are available to women vulnerable to change, and they see that as an increasing threat to women's equality. So with a lot of laws, many have been sort of transposed into UK law. So it's not a case that now we've left the EU, those laws disappear or anything like that. They are in UK law. But the key point is that we no longer have that European underpinning. So there's no longer that safety net. And that's on things such as equal pay law, sex discrimination law, maternity leave. All of that is sort of based in EU law, which no longer applies to us. So in theory, what that means is that the government of the day could, should they choose to, you know, they no longer have to abide by that kind of basic standard that the EU sets. So it not only means that, but it also means the UK doesn't need to keep pace with developments in EU law. So one kind of good example of that is there's a work-life balance directive working its way through the EU at the moment, and that would give rights to carers for paid leave. So it is the case that the UK government, it's kind of up to them whether they choose to take up that cause. There's nothing that actually means they have to. So that's the kind of arguments that are being made on that. There's also recent remarks by Women's and Equalities Minister Liz Truss have not really done anything to allay concerns. She, in a speech last month, she said the government had focused too much on issues of race, gender and sexuality at the expense of sort of geographic inequality and class. When I went to the UK government for a comment on the concerns that have been raised, they sort of said that her remarks, you know, didn't mean that she was choosing one group over another and therefore didn't care about women's rights or anything like that, that they want equality for everyone. But amongst the lawyers and the women's rights experts, they're saying that those remarks don't make them feel confident that there couldn't be a kind of rollback of some of the hard-fought rights that women have at the moment. So that's where a lot of concerns lie. I mean, it's a really wide topic in that there's also sort of international schemes that are now, I guess, we're not part of. So you've got European protection orders. That means, you know, if a woman is fleeing, you know, she's protected in one member state from somebody that is, say, domestic, she's from perpetrators of domestic abuse or stalking or something like that. Those are recognised right across the EU. That's a system that, you know, we're no longer part of. So it's really wide ranging, the kind of things that are under threat here. And there is a great deal of concern there.
And when you were speaking with these groups and these people that the organizations that look out for these things, can you give us a sense of just how concerned they were? Is it a major pressing concern? Is it something that they are actively wanting to highlight further as we journey on from being members of the EU?
Yeah, I mean, they've been calling all through the debate that women's rights groups asked to be included in the sort of negotiation stages, and they claim they were just fobbed off and there was never any attempt to sort of engage them, and they don't feel there has been a priority on it at all. They are hoping, you know, they keep continuing to lobby government to listen to their concerns, and I know obviously we've got a different approach between the Scottish and UK governments on it. I mean, the Scottish government have said to me that they recognise that there's a potential there for an adverse impact on women's rights, and they similarly have been pushing the UK government, because it's really the UK government that has the power in this area, to sort of make some kind of women's rights groups and lawyers want the UK government to make some kind of, I guess, public statement or some sort of public commitment that this is something that is a priority for them. I mean, it ties in with the wider debate around workers' rights more broadly. I spoke to Professor Nicole Busby. She's a human rights professor at the University of Glasgow. And she said that where she sees the real threat is that the UK is going to want to make trade deals, you know, now with countries that aren't in the EU. So those countries are all able to sort of trade freely with each other, whereas there's an argument there that the government may think that the sort of worker protections that we have are relatively expensive and could be perceived as sort of non-competitive. So that, therefore, that's where her concern lies, is around whether those protections could be under threat in a bid to make the UK a more competitive, you know, a more competitive place to trade with for the countries that aren't in the EU. So it's definitely, I think the overall issue of workers' rights is being, you know, is finally starting to be looked at, hopefully.
And worrying, of course, because of the sort of impending economic impact that the coronavirus has, we just don't really know how anything's going to be over the next couple of years, I imagine. Now, thinking of that, and despite the fact that Mr. Johnson came up on Thursday, there was actually a very important day on the Scottish parliamentary calendar on Thursday. Also, we had Finance Secretary Kate Forbes unveiling the Scottish government's budget for the next year, which was dominated by the coronavirus and Scotland's recovery from it. Callum, you took quite a good look at the Scottish budget and Ms. Forbes and and how it came across to Parliament. Can you talk us through the sort of the main talking points of this year's budget?
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Paul. I mean, you're right to say that the response to the coronavirus kind of dominated the statement. Kate Forbes said described it as having shaken our society and economy to its core, and she said that the exceptional circumstances require an exceptional response. I mean, we should just say that we're speaking on Friday morning at the moment, and as we all know from the past, it tends to take a day or two or even longer for the real story from a budget to emerge. People all over the country will be sort of crunching the numbers this morning and seeing what it all means for them. And I think we'll hear more today from the councils and others about the implications. But I mean, on the face of it, I thought it was a budget that didn't really have a giant rabbit out of the hat sort of moment. But it did have quite a lot of sort of helpful measures spread fairly evenly, with money to help household budgets, to help businesses, you know, mental health services, money to tackle the drug deaths issue as well. And I think that was probably the right tone to strike, although you know, it may have been forced on Kate Forbes a bit as she was unveiling her spending plans before the UK government has announced its own budget, meaning, you know, a lot of the figures were up in the air really, and subject to change. There's extension to business rates relief for at least 3 months and other things like that. But I think the thing that will be noticed by the most, you know, the largest number of people, will be the sort of money to freeze council tax and also, you know, the effectively freezing income tax as well, kind of raising the bands by inflation only. You know, that might not have a dramatic effect on people's finances. I think Kate Forbes said everyone would be paying slightly less, and that's to do with changes in the personal allowance. It's very slightly less, I think, is the feeling. But, you know, it'll still reach a lot of people, everyone really. And, you know, there is an election coming up, so I'm sure that would have been part of the government's thinking as well.
Now, it has been a big week for Miss Forbes. She did announce her engagement on Sunday. So congratulations to her and her partner. But I suppose it's been a big week at the end of a really quite unexpected but big year for the finance secretary. Also, we do have an election coming up in May, and Nicola Sturgeon will be leading the SNP into that. But there's been a lot of speculation as to who could replace her. Cam, did you get the impression that the statement that she made yesterday, and given the fact that it's been a quite a tumultuous year for Ms. Forbes, in the sense that she showed it was almost as if it was a pitch to be future leader of the party or a future first minister?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I thought Kate Forbes did quite well. She was quite assured again. And, you know, you forget she's only 30. Obviously, everyone remembers last year when she was kind of parachuted in the night before the budget after Derek Mackay was forced to resign over messages he had been sending to a 16-year-old. You know, last year no one would have blamed her if she had struggled, and I mentioned this in the piece I wrote yesterday, you know, but she didn't. She didn't struggle in the end. But this year, you know, her opponents wouldn't have been so forgiven. But you know, I think she did perform well again, and it is good news for the SNP, because to be honest, they're in this weird place at the moment where their polling's through the roof, but at the same time they seem to be imploding a bit internally. You know, in some ways it's quite incredible given her popularity, but Nicola Sturgeon does seem to be under a bit of pressure. And the party doesn't have any great number of obvious successors lined up ready to take over when that time comes. So, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think if Kate Forbes continues the way she's going, then she will definitely be linked with those kind of roles more and more going forward.
Now, one man who probably ruled himself out of becoming First Minister anytime soon is none other than former Justice Secretary, Kenny McCaskill, after it was discovered that he has been living in historic Banffshire, which is up Murray Way, in a house on Speyside. What's wrong with that, here you ask? Well, he is the Member of Parliament for East Lothian, 170 miles or 273 kilometres or 550 kilometre round trip to visit constituents. Now, of course, there is a travel ban in place. We are all deterred from travelling or unnecessarily moving from one local authority area to the other. I think we counted it as at least three or four local authority areas you have to go through to get from Speyside to East Lothian. Mr. McCaskill spoke to us and said that he had done nothing really wrong, but Ms. Sturgeon, the First Minister, has been talking at quite some length for the last month now about not just maintaining the letter of the law, but behaving within the spirit. Don't create your own loopholes. Don't create your own laws just because it makes you feel better for doing so. We know that Mr. McCaskill has visited East Lothian at least twice in that time. So I think without any further ado, this week's Stoosh of the Week goes to Kenny McCaskill.
Stoosh of the Week.
Now, speaking of people that seem to have been in Parliament for a very, very long time, Adele, you have been taking a look at the parliamentarians at Holyrood who joined in 1999 and after 22 years of solid service will be leaving in May. It's taking you quite some time and you have put a heck of a lot of work into this. Talk us through it and tell us why we should all be picking up the first edition tomorrow on our website.
So tomorrow we launch my 1999 club project, which is something I've been working on for several months now, I think. As part of it, I've spoken to, there's a dozen MSPs from the 1999 intake who will be stepping down ahead of this year's election. So I thought it'd be a nice idea to speak to them in depth, get their thoughts on more than two decades at Parliament. I mean, there is obviously every election cycle, there is churn with people leaving the parliament and new faces coming in. That happens all the time. But I think there is a perception this year that there's a great deal of experience leaving. There's a lot of some of the big SNP hitters from government are leaving. You've got, you know, several cabinet secretaries will be standing down. And I don't want to give too much away, but basically I spoke to them about some of the biggest changes that they've seen in that time. There's been a sort of perception that the Scottish Parliament really has revolutionised things. So I've looked at that. I've looked at whether they think the Scottish Parliament has fulfilled its original intentions. And I have spoken to them personally about their various varied decisions to step down and where they see things going. So, yeah, that will be going live tomorrow with 12 separate interviews, and there will be video and audio elements as well. So I'd say it's worth checking out.
Excellent. A multimedia extravaganza. I'm looking forward to all of that. Now, just before we go, I think it's worth noting that the Stooshy, along with a number of DC Thompson podcasts, but I know your all main concern is this one, has been nominated for a couple of awards with the Publisher Podcast Awards coming up in April. We have been put forward for Best Political Podcast and Best News Podcast, and we're up against some proper heavy hitters at the New Statesman, the Telegraph, and we would just like to say thank you for that nomination, and thank you to producer Chris, without which none of it would be possible. On that note, I've been Paul Malik. Thanks to Dell, Dan and Callum for joining us this week. We'll see you same Stooshy place, same Stooshy time next week. Goodbye.
The Stooshy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you are better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph and The Evening Express work hard every day, online and in print, to bring you careful reporting and analysis to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, Westminster and beyond. Subscribe to The Stooshy today, recommend us to friends and family, rate and review it if you have a moment, and let us know what you think of what we cover and how we cover it on Twitter and Facebook. We're Stooshy Scott on both. Be better briefed with The Stooshy from DC Thompson Media.